High schoolers are busy, but no one's too busy to help fight cancer. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is looking for their next Student Visionaries of the Year. Could that be your child? High schoolers who participate in this 7-week philanthropic leadership development program gain valuable life skills like project management, communication, financial literacy, and entrepreneurship. Forming strong teams behind them, they fundraise for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society in honor of a pediatric blood cancer survivor right in their local community. Most importantly, this campaign is an opportunity for high schoolers to engage in meaningful work within their community and make a real impact on the lives of blood cancer patients and their families. Sound like something your child might be interested in? You can learn more about Student Visionaries of the Year or even nominate a student at lls.org/students. That's lls.org/students.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Just a kiss, a smile from the
heart. Welcome to another episode of You Must Remember This, the podcast dedicated to exploring the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century, part of the Panoply Network. I'm your host, Karina Longworth, and this is another story in our ongoing series, MGM Stories. This episode, like all of the episodes in this series, was inspired by a post made on the forum at youmustrememberthispodcast.com by a listener. This episode was inspired by a post by Shauna Elizabeth, who called in to tell us more about what she wanted to know.
Lana Turner has been mentioned in several episodes of the show, from the Madonna episode to the Carol Lombard episode. Her discovery story is Hollywood legend, and her reputation as a seductive ingenue seems to have unsettled other starlets who didn't want the sweater girl getting too close to their leading men. But I'm interested in learning more about Turner's own relationships, including her many marriages and her relationship with her daughter, Cheryl Crane, and also the murder of Johnny Stompanato. It seems like in Turner's case, on-screen drama truly was an imitation of life.
Thanks for the suggestion, and extra thanks for the pun. It's true that Lana Turner is one movie star whose off-screen life was a lot more interesting than most of her movies. And she was definitely an exception to the rule at MGM in that she didn't need the studio to create a fake image for her. She didn't need to be groomed or made over. Her beautician mother had trained her from childhood how to present herself to bring out the best of her natural beauty and to use costuming and comportment to hide any rough edges or raw vulnerabilities. For 20 years, Turner worked hard and played harder, and her real, off-screen life and persona became more exciting than anything MGM could have scripted, to the extent that the studio occasionally used their habit of feeding columnist stories in order to publicly scold her. The headlines Turner generated weren't a problem because they diminished her box office value. If anything, they did the opposite. They were a problem only because MGM didn't like anything it couldn't control. What producers ended up doing at MGM and at other studios to regain that control was to start formulating movie vehicles for Turner that borrowed the circumstances of the actress's real life. This is one matter when it comes to art imitating an adult woman's life, even when that woman's life encompassed a number of scandalous relationships. But as we'll see, it would be another matter when the movie started to imitate Lana Turner's daughter's life. By the time Cheryl Crane was 14 and watching her unstable home life reflected back to her in one of her mother's biggest hit movies, reality and fantasy must have seemed pretty confused. Within weeks, Cheryl was on the cover of every newspaper in town for murdering her mother's boyfriend. A shocking twist of real life that was certainly stranger than fiction. Join us, won't you, for the story of Lana Turner, Cheryl Crane, and Johnny Stampinato.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/remember. netsuite.com/remember. netsuite.com/remember.
The legend of Lana Turner begins with her being discovered at Schwab's drugstore while sipping a chocolate malted. The truth of the discovery is somewhat more banal. But already by that point, she had lived a life full of richer drama than most of what she'd be asked to play. Born in 1921 in Idaho, Julia Jean Mildred Frances Turner arrived in Los Angeles in 1936. Her mother, Mildred, who had been 15 when she gave birth, had been left by the child's father, a sometime bootlegger who soon thereafter was found murdered the morning after leaving a card game from which he had walked away the winner of a big pot. A few years later, Mildred and her daughter hitched a ride with a friend down to Los Angeles, where Mildred worked in a beauty parlor, and the younger Miss Turner enrolled at Hollywood High. An indifferent student, Turner would sometimes cut class and sip a soda, not at Schwab's, but at Topps Cafe, which was across the street from her school. She was there doing just that one day in early 1936 when a man named Billy Wilkerson spotted her across the counter, took in her adolescent charms, and tossed her the immortal line, "Would you like to be in the movies?" To which Turner responded, "I don't know. I'd have to ask my mother." She was 15, the same age her mother had been when she had given birth. Wilkerson referred Turner to Zeppo Marx, who had left the Marx Brothers and become a prestigious talent agent. Eventually, Turner ended up in the office of director Mervyn LeRoy, who was making a movie based on a real-life incident in which a teenage girl was raped and murdered in a small southern town. He needed a girl to play the victim of the crime, a girl who could walk on screen and make an immediate impact. That way, when she would be violently disappeared after 12 minutes on screen, the loss would be that much more powerful. He needed a girl whose physical appeal was obvious, who remained innocent enough so that no one would feel like she deserved what happened to her. This Judy Turner had what Leroy was looking for, except that her name sounded too common. They had a meeting about what she should be called. The now 16-year-old suggested Lana. Unlike other stars of this era, there's no indication that Lana Turner felt any kind of remorse for the quote-unquote real self she was leaving behind. In Lana's key scene in They Won't Forget, she walks confidently past the camera, her character unaware that she was about to be fatally sexually assaulted off-screen. Director Leroy noted admiringly the way Lana's bosom seemed to move in a rhythm all its own. In the scene, she's wearing a skin-tight sweater, belted at the waist over a pencil skirt. Thanks to the production code, the film wasn't going to be able to depict the rape visually, but Leroy felt this costume would work two jobs. On the one hand, sweaters were synonymous with schoolgirls, conveying youth and inexperience. On the other hand, as Leroy put it, "I figured a tight sweater on a beautiful girl would convey to the audience everything we couldn't say outright." The sweater worked. Lana Turner made such an impact in They Won't Forget that she became internationally known as the Sweater Girl, and a scene in the film in which she sips a chocolate malted at a drugstore and Fields advances from the soda jerk was conflated with or rolled into her official biography. A year later, Mervyn LeRoy hopped from Warner Brothers to MGM, and Lana went with him. She was quickly slotted into two of the studio's popular series. As one of Mickey Rooney's sophisticated alternatives to Judy Garland in Love Finds Andy Hardy, and as a wanton bad girl in Calling Dr. Kildare. Soon Turner had convinced MGM that it was time to graduate her to juicier parts, which she got in 1941's Ziegfeld Girl, in which she shares the screen with Judy Garland and Hedy Lamarr and walks away with the picture. Literally. Lana plays a starlet who becomes an alcoholic, and in her famous climactic scene, she tumbles down a flight of stairs. By this point, Lana's naturally auburn hair had been bleached a white blonde. MGM may have been trying to use her to fill the vacancy left a few years earlier by the death of Jean Harlow, but Ziegfeld Girl, the first film in which Turner was given real material to act, demonstrated that this blonde's essence was very different from Harlow's screwball playfulness. The glamour Lana projects in Ziegfeld Girl has a darkness to it. She's a girl gifted with uncommon beauty, but she doesn't let it make her happy. Instead, she throws it all away. The bad girl who could be breathtakingly naive, whose recklessness could be thrilling precisely because it was so much a part of a pursuit of happiness. This is what people loved about Lana Turner, and it found its greatest expression in her off-screen love life. If Lana Turner had a theme song, it would be I Fall in Love Too Easily. Not long after she settled into her new life as a star, Lana started dating Hollywood lawyer Greg Boutzer. Lana considered herself engaged to Boutzer, and she gave him her virginity. But when Boutzer stood Lana up on her 20th birthday, a furious Lana accepted a date with Artie Shaw, the band leader who may or may not have led Judy Garland to believe that he was her boyfriend. By the end of Artie and Lana's first dinner date, they were in Vegas getting married. To say they barely knew one another somewhat overstates things. When they finally made it back to Artie's house after the ceremony and after fighting their way through a melee of frantic reporters and photographers, they consummated the marriage. And as Turner remembered, it was anticlimactic. "I experienced nothing but a question," she wrote later. "What am I doing underneath this man?" The marriage lasted 4.5 months. When she was single again, Lana became such a dedicated party girl that she was nicknamed the Queen of the Nightclubs. This was at the peak of a certain kind of Hollywood hotspot: Ciro's, the Brown Derby, the Coconut Grove. restaurants with lavish decor and full dance floors and nightly entertainment, where to simply show up was to be complicit in a narrative disseminated the next day in newspapers by photographers who roamed the floor or planted themselves by the door. Lana loved to stay out late, to dance and drink and flirt, but she also understood by now what it meant to have your photo in the newspaper every single morning, and she was all too happy to play her part in the show, dressing to the nines and delighting in making entrances. Turner's love life during this time is a tricky thing to figure out. Everyone she was photographed with, on the clock or off, was rumored to be her new lover. There are reports that she was a nymphomaniac, that she pursued not just co-stars, but any man in any walk of life that she fancied. In her autobiography, which was published when Lana was in her early 60s, and which is very carefully, even brilliantly worded to seem like a tell-all while actually omitting many details about many things, Turner insists this image of herself was a media invention, and she strenuously denies affairs she is supposed to have had with stars like Frank Sinatra and Clark Gable. Over and over again, she writes things like, "If I didn't make love for weeks, I was content." And that line she wrote in the context of Tyrone Power, who she characterizes as her great love who got away. I don't know who Turner actually had sex with, and I don't really care. All that matters, I think, is that the idea of her as a man-eater was in the culture then, to the extent that Carol Lombard apparently got on the plane that would bring her to her death because she thought her husband couldn't be trusted to work with Turner while his wife was out of town. And the idea persists to this day, maybe because it was the role Turner looked like she was born to play. It's not an accident that Turner's most indelible role of the first half of her career was as the scheming seductress of Tay Garnett's The Postman Always Rings Twice. Like most of the great moments of Turner's career, costuming played a key role in that film. She makes her entrance wearing short shorts and a midriff-bearing halter in blinding white, as mind-numbingly sexy an ensemble for 1946 as the censors would allow. If affairs are tough to document, marriages are a matter of public record, and Lana had 7 marriages to 8 men, nearly all of them marked by some kind of wishful thinking or failure of judgment on Turner's part. About 2 years after her split from Artie Shaw, Lana went back to Vegas to elope with Steve Crane, who would go on to launch a successful chain of Polynesian restaurants, but at the time of their marriage was a nobody from nowhere with a wife whom he had started but had not finished divorcing at the time of his marriage to Turner. By the time Turner found this out, she was pregnant with a baby she desperately wanted after having been forced to abort Artie Shaw's child when they split up. She would also miscarry several times, thanks to her unusual blood type. Turner annulled her marriage to Crane, and then when Steve's divorce was final, they re-eloped. Although by that point, Lana was already mentally out the door. The marriage was over by 1944. Cheryl Crane, Lana's daughter, would spend much of her childhood raised by governesses and her grandmother. It was a full year before she and her mom were ever alone together. And she'd spent her entire childhood and much of her adulthood meeting new friends of mommy. Next up was millionaire Bob Topping, who Turner married in a ceremony that was eviscerated in the press for its opulence. Life magazine ran a cynical piece with a headline that read, "Lana Turner's fourth and positively last time." This is all the more shocking because the nuptials were held at the house of Billy Wilkerson, Lana's old discoverer and then still the publisher of The Hollywood Reporter. And the coverage of Turner's marriage to Topping seems all the more callous when you know that a few years later, when Topping asked for a divorce, Turner slit her wrists and swallowed a bottle of pills in a suicide attempt that was reported as a shower accident.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
The attitude that permeated the press coverage of Turner's fourth wedding would prefigure the tone of the wave of Hollywood metafilms of the following decade. Movies in which Hollywood was trying to prove it was hip to a culture that was moving past movies to television by making movies critical of the movie industry's decadence while also celebrating, in form and in content, the aesthetic spectacle that only movies could deliver. Lana Turner starred in one of the best of these movies, The Bad and the Beautiful. We've talked about The Bad and the Beautiful before on one of our first podcasts about the RKO horror movie mastermind Val Lewden, who was one of the inspirations for Jonathan Shields, the maverick producer character played in The Bad and the Beautiful by Kirk Douglas. Another inspiration for that character was the man we devoted our most recent two episodes to, David O. Selznick. And it seems like Georgia Lorison, the character played by Lana Turner, was at least in part inspired by Selznick's discovery and second wife, Jennifer Jones, as well as by Lana's longtime friend, sometime rival, and neighbor, Judy Garland, who was also the ex-wife of the film's director, Vincent Minnelli. So Lana knew this material well. But aside from the fact that Georgia, like Lana, was a beautiful actress with a taste for vodka, The Bad and the Beautiful ironically cast Turner against type, insofar as her established screen type had for a dozen years pulled from her off-screen life. Georgia was an insecure alcoholic actress who, at first, needed her producer/lover to prop her up, and only when he betrayed her could she allow her heartbreak to propel her into independence. Lana Turner fell in love a lot, but never with a man who was in any position to help or promote her own career, and she always maintained a firm line between church and state when it came to her number of boyfriends and husbands who could have used her help to goose their own Hollywood careers. Turner is front and center in one of the film's most famous scenes, in which she weeps while driving rain-blind streets away from Shields, who has just rejected her. She loses control of the vehicle, accidentally or on purpose, but she regains it and survives. This was a very difficult scene to shoot technically. Minnelli had a special effects car created to shoot in, and when Turner appears to be bounced almost out of the driver's seat, that was the actress really losing control. But I'm more impressed by the previous scene, in which Turner catches Douglas's character with another woman, and for several long moments, stands frozen, her face completely still, while Douglas loses control. The Bad and the Beautiful is one of the most decadent melodramas of the era. The fur-trimmed gown Turner is wearing in this scene is absolutely insane. But the bigness only works because it's counterpointed by captivating moments of subtlety and grace, like that Turner reaction shot. Lana Turner had been good before when given half a chance, but if any performance over the course of her entire career should have convinced the industry in general, and her home studio MGM specifically, to take her seriously, this was it. But it didn't happen. At the Oscars, which was then, as now, a key barometer of the image of itself that the industry wanted to project, The Bad and the Beautiful was nominated for 6 Oscars and won 5, including Best Supporting Actress, for Gloria Graham, who played a silly but tragic Southern Belle. We're going to talk about Graham next week, and we'll give her work in the film its due then, but that she won the Oscar for 9 minutes of screen time setting a new record for the smallest part to ever win an acting Oscar, while Turner wasn't even nominated, says something about how Turner was seen by her own industry. By the mid-1950s, of course, that industry was changing. MGM was now run by Dory Sherry, who acted like he wasn't sure they needed Lana Turner around now that they had the much younger Elizabeth Taylor. MGM cast Turner in garbage films that didn't make any money, possibly as an excuse to let her contract lapse. She made a couple of movies in Europe, mostly to be close to her soon-to-be fourth husband, Lex Barker, who was working in Italy after having retired as cinema's 10th Tarzan. By 1956, Turner was out at MGM. Turner's finances were very bad. Her accountants had misfiled her taxes, and in order to pay back the government, she had gone into debt to MGM. Like many of her husbands, Lex spent more than he brought in. In her autobiography, Turner wrote, "The marriage was rocky. Often we quarreled about the fact that my income was much larger than his." She also notes that she had heard stories about Lex's infidelities, and that she didn't believe his denials. There went another marriage down the drain. "Why was I always attracted to the wrong man?" Lana lamented in her autobiography. In her own autobiography, published 6 years after her mother's, Lana's daughter Cheryl tells a somewhat different story. Cheryl accused her mother's husband, Lex Barker, of raping her repeatedly for 3 years, beginning when she was just 10 years old. Cheryl describes in sometimes horrifying detail how Lex would come to her room at night and force himself on her, how he told her that it was a stepfather's job to give the children of his wife, quote-unquote, sex lessons. He told her that if she told anyone, she'd go to juvenile hall, which he described as a prison for girls where they give you bread and water and you're alone behind bars for the rest of your life. Just phrasing it like that suggests Lex was smart. He must have known how lonely and isolated Cheryl felt just living in Lana Turner's house, which she was barely allowed to leave until she was sent to boarding school. As Cheryl later described life as a celebrity child, "Everyone knows you, and you don't know anyone." The specter of juvenile hall haunted her and kept her from revealing the abuse. Finally, in the spring of 1957, after Lex hit her in the face until she blacked out and raped her so hard she couldn't stand up, Cheryl finally confessed to her grandmother, who insisted she tell Lana. Lana, at first, didn't want to believe it. She insisted on taking Cheryl to a doctor for confirmation. The doctor examined Cheryl and told her mother that the girl was telling the truth. "She has been injured," the doctor said. "She should have had stitches. There are definite signs of violent entry, and more than once." Back at the house, Lana found Lex asleep in their bed and couldn't join him. The next morning, her husband asked her why she didn't come to bed the night before. To Lana's icy stare, Lex said, "What has your daughter been telling you?" "Listen, you," was Lana's response, according to Cheryl. "I want you out of here in 20 minutes, and you know why." Turner doesn't talk about any of this in her own memoir. Maybe mother and daughter had agreed that this was Cheryl's story to tell. When Lana Turner got an offer to lend her star power to the film adaptation of the hit novel Peyton Place, she wasn't in the position to turn the part down, because she needed the money. In her book, Lana called the part of Connie, a glamorous yet extremely buttoned-up single mother of a teenage girl in a small town, a departure. What she meant by departure is that to play the mother of a teenage daughter would be to acknowledge that she was old enough to be the mother of a teenage daughter. That she was, in fact, the mother of a teenage daughter. In her book, Cheryl wrote of her mother's work in Peyton Place, "I knew why her acting was so good. It wasn't acting." In fact, Connie is an eminently logical transitional role for Turner, who was just 36 at the time, but had already seen a new generation of ingenues like Audrey Hepburn and Kim Novak start to pass her by. In Paid in Place, Turner would play a woman who fronts as if she's beyond sex, but she does it only because she's hiding a secret, reckless romantic past. The parallels to Turner's real life went beyond the fact that, like Connie, Lana had fathered a child with a man who she wasn't destined to be with in the long run. For one thing, on-screen Lana's character was so concerned with appearances that she and her daughter would have a falling out over the mother's false impression that the daughter had risked their reputation. This superficiality was familiar to Cheryl Crane, who grew up knowing how to present herself to dinner guests like Luella Parsons, who had barely been allowed to touch her mother for fear of mussing the cosmetic mask that she wore on screen and off. When Cheryl saw the movie and watched her mother look at her on-screen daughter with disapproval, it was like deja vu. There's also the fact that Paid in Place's plot turns on the rape of a beautiful teenage girl by her crude stepfather. And then there's the trial, which prefigured a courtroom scene in real life. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Paid in Place was released in December 1957. It became the second highest grossing film of 1958, and it was nominated for 9 Oscars. And for the first and only time, Lana was included in the nominations. She found out about the honor while she was vacationing in Mexico with Johnny Stampinato, her boyfriend of about a year. Stampinato was a low-level gangster, a bodyguard for Mickey Cohen. He had wormed his way into Turner's life by cold-calling her under the name John Steele, and then he got to work on the daughter, giving the then 13-year-old Cheryl her own horse. When Lana found out Stampinato's real identity from a concerned friend several months later, she tried to break it off, she says, but Johnny wouldn't go away. And at first, she admitted later, she didn't exactly want him to. His consuming passion was strangely exciting, Lana wrote. Call it forbidden fruit or whatever, but this attraction was very deep. Knowing she probably shouldn't be dating a gangster, when Turner left LA to shoot a movie with a young Sean Connery in London, she left Johnny behind, assuming the relationship would fizzle out while she was away. But on set, she was lonely, and Johnny came to London, where, according to Cheryl, he got in a fistfight with Connery, who easily won. And then one night, Johnny picked a fight with Lana. He pinned her down and crushed her larynx before Lana's maid walked in. Scotland Yard got involved, and Johnny was deported. But Johnny knew Lana was planning to vacation in Acapulco after the shoot, and when she arrived at her layover in Copenhagen, he was waiting there for her, with his own ticket on to Mexico. Lana felt trapped. She couldn't start a scene in an international airport. She figured, in Mexico, she'd figure out some way to get rid of him. But she didn't. And in Mexico, Stampinato started threatening Lana at gunpoint almost daily. Sometimes he told her he could have her mother and daughter killed. Sometimes he told her that he would kill himself if she managed to leave him. Every time, Lana became a little bit more scared. But she was still determined to figure this out for herself without asking for help because, as she put it, underlying everything was my shame. I was so ashamed. I didn't want anybody to know my predicament, how foolish I'd been, how I'd taken him at face value and been completely duped. This was a woman who was mockingly posited by the international press as an aging sex bomb with terrible taste in men. Her fear of living up to that image kept her in danger. They returned to Los Angeles. John wasn't happy that Lana didn't want to take him to the Oscars, but he allowed her to take her daughter instead. Lana didn't win, but she and Cheryl had an incredible night, dancing and drinking champagne into the wee hours. When they returned to Lana's suite at the Bel Air Hotel, Cheryl went to bed and Lana found John waiting for her in her room. He wasn't supposed to be there. He hadn't been invited. Lana told John she was tired and asked him to leave. He refused. He slapped her hard in the face. She said, "Don't you dare touch me again." This is what happened next, direct from Lana's autobiography. "He cracked me a second time, this time knocking me down. He yanked me up and began hitting me with his fists. I went flying across the room into the bar, sending glasses shattering to the floor. John had slapped me around before, but this was a full-scale beating, and I was in fear for my life." Lana survived the beating, and soon thereafter, she came clean to her daughter about what had been happening between her and John. When Cheryl asked her mother why she didn't call the police, particularly since the current deputy chief of the LAPD was Andy Anderson, a family friend who frequently drank flaming grogs at the bar Cheryl's father owned in Beverly Hills, Lana said, "The publicity! The press would have a field day."
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Cheryl later wrote, "I felt like I was talking to somebody with no brain." But she also understood why Lana was unable to handle this crisis rationally. Cheryl saw that her mother had been deeply affected by having been dropped by MGM, not just emotionally, but practically. When she was at MGM, as Cheryl put it, an army of service departments had made all her great and small worries go away. After MGM, economies had to be made and the soldiers cut back, Cheryl wrote. Now, raw recruit that I was, it was my turn. In other words, what happened next might not have happened if Lana had been able to confide her fears about Johnny Stampinato to someone like Eddie Mannix at MGM, who could have made the problem go away and protect Lana from repercussions. But she didn't have that anymore. She didn't feel like there was anywhere to turn to for protection. A week after the Academy Awards, Lana and Cheryl moved into a new house in Beverly Hills. John was still hanging around. On Good Friday, Cheryl was up in her room when she heard Lana and John arguing. "You damn bitch," Cheryl heard John yell. "You're not getting rid of me that easy. I'll cut you up." They somehow ended up in Cheryl's bedroom, where she was doing homework and had Sergeant Bilko on the TV. A terrified Lana gestured towards Phil Silvers' face on the TV and said, "I'd like to be able to watch this show for a moment." When John didn't go away, Lana went downstairs for a drink, and John followed, and she went back upstairs, and he followed, and the yelling continued. They ended up in Lana's bedroom, which was painted a color Cheryl called arousal pink. Fearful for what was going on behind her mother's closed door, Cheryl knocked and said, "Mother, can I see you for a second?" Mother and daughter had a brief conference in the bathroom, and then Lana returned and told John to go. "This is a brand new house and a brand new start for me, and I want you to leave," she said. "You fucking do as I say," was John's response. Lana told Cheryl to go back to her bedroom. As she walked away, Cheryl could hear John continue to threaten her mother. "Wherever you go, I'll find you. If someone makes a living with their hands, break their hands. If someone makes a living with her face, destroy her face. I'll cut you good, baby. You'll never work again. And don't think I won't also get your mother and your kid."
I have people to do the job for me. And I'll watch.
Cheryl didn't go back to her bedroom. She ran downstairs, and in the kitchen, she saw, amongst a bunch of household items that her mother had just bought that day, a brand new kitchen knife. Cheryl had never used a kitchen before, let alone a knife, but she instinctively grabbed it. Scare him, she thought. That's it. Scare him. Cheryl went upstairs and banged on her mother's bedroom door. She heard John threaten her mother.
Cunt, you're dead.
Lana was crying and wailing, begging John to leave. Suddenly, the door to the bedroom flew open. Cheryl could see that John was behind her mother, that he had his hands raised like he was about to hit her. Cheryl stepped forward with the knife in her hand, and John moved right into it. Cheryl wrote, "For three ghastly heartbeats, our bodies fused." Their eyes locked, too, and John stared at her as he asked,
"My God, Cheryl, what have you done?"
He pulled backward off the knife and, still looking straight at Cheryl, fell to the ground. The 14-year-old dropped the knife and ran into her bedroom, where she curled up into a ball and cried. Lana wasn't sure what had just happened. She saw that John's sweater was cut, and when she lifted it up, blood started gushing out. Cheryl spent the next 24 hours or so in a fugue state, with what she called the asbestos curtain over her eyes. She kept saying, "I'm so sorry," and "I didn't mean to." She said it all the way to the police station, and then to a jail cell, where she spent the night. By the time she was transferred to juvenile hall the next day, she was wondering why she couldn't seem to cry. With Cheryl in juvie awaiting a coroner's inquest that would decide the next steps the justice system would take, and Lana sequestered in Beverly Hills under heavy sedation, the media circus took over. When reporters suggested that Cheryl was going to get off easy because she was the daughter of a celebrity, family friend Chief Anderson said that on the contrary, there would be no special favors, and in fact, he would be pushing for an indictment for murder rather than for justifiable homicide. Stampinato's brother Carmine and mob boss Mickey Cohen waged their own campaigns. Carmine demanded that Lana take a lie detector test, suggesting that it was the mother who stabbed his brother and who was making her daughter take the rap for it. Cohen leaked Lana's love letters to Johnny to the press, hoping their florid declarations of passion would prove it a lie that Lana didn't want Johnny around. Reached in Rome, Lex Barker told a reporter that Cheryl was, quote, two-faced, and gloated that he had warned Lana that someday she'd get in big trouble. Paid in Place was in its fourth month of release and climbing up the box office chart. While the coroner's inquest that would decide Cheryl's fate was happening, while her mother was testifying in real life for the first time after playing countless courtroom scenes for the movies, the teenager was watching Seven Brides for Seven Brothers on the TV at Juvenile Hall. She watched her mother's Paid in Place co-star, Russ Tamblyn, dancing across the screen, and thought about how she had danced with him just a few weeks earlier at the Oscars. The inquest declared that the crime had been justifiable homicide, and the DA decided not to prosecute for murder. Mickey Cohen made a statement. "It's the first time in my life I've ever seen a dead man convicted of his own murder." Cheryl stayed in juvie while it was decided what would become of her. There was essentially a custody battle. Cheryl wanted to live with her father, but she didn't want to hurt her mother by saying so. So she declared that she wanted to live with her grandmother, and the court agreed. Lana Turner was now in massive debt. Cheryl's legal bills had averaged $1,000 a day during the whole ordeal, and Lana still owed money to MGM, and after being branded the mother of a murderess in the media, she had no idea if anyone would want to cast her again. But Ross Hunter did. Universal's producer of lavish melodramas approached Turner about starring in Douglas Sirk's remake of Imitation of Life, about two single moms, one white and one black, and their respective struggles with their teenage daughters. Hunter was transparent about his interest in the ways in which the material would play on what the public knew about Lana's real life. To exaggerate those parallels, in this version of the story, Lana's character would be an actress whose career causes her to neglect her daughter, until her daughter becomes involved with the mother's boyfriend. Lana took the job for the paltry salary of $2,500 a week, but she negotiated a then uncommon deal that would net her a very large portion of the film's profits. Cheryl felt extremely hurt by the ways in which Imitation of Life referenced her real-life mother-daughter troubles, but she went along with the studio's plan to include her and her supposedly tight bond with Lana in the publicity because she was afraid not to. Imitation of Life became a huge hit, by some reports rescuing a struggling Universal and netting Turner over $5 million in its first year of release. But it made Cheryl feel colder toward her mother, and the next few years were tough. Cheryl would end up in a disciplinary school, and then what she called a luxurious asylum, before she was 18. Lana would marry three more times over the next 10 years. She'd never have another hit like Imitation of Life, and she'd make her last film in 1980. Cheryl would eventually find her calling working at her father's restaurant, having come out as a lesbian as a teenager. At a party at Marlon Brando's house in 1968, she met Josh LaRoyce, a woman who is still her partner today. Cheryl and Lana were close by the time Lana died in 1995. The phrase, sweater girl, made it into the first sentence of her obituary. Thanks for listening to You Must Remember This. Today's episode was written, narrated, and produced by Karina Longworth. That's me. Our editor is Henry Malofsky, and our research intern is Allie Gemmel. For more information about this episode and other episodes, please go to our website, youmustrememberthispodcast.com. At our website, you can find our forum, where you can make suggestions for future episodes, and we also have show notes for every episode which contain the sources used in the research process, because you can't put footnotes on a podcast. If you like the show, do us a favor and tell anybody that you can, any way that you can. You can tweet about us. Our Twitter handle is @RememberThisPod. If you subscribe on iTunes and rate and review us there, that also helps people find the show. We'll be back next week with another tale from the secrets and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. Join us then, won't you? Good night.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard for love.